Hey guys, Devin Alford. Thanks so much, Brad. And just to echo what Brad said, you know, whenever I come into a detoxer facility, you know, there's a couple things I start off with, which I think are important for you guys to know, which is what he said in the beginning, is A, I'm not paid to be here. I'm not a treatment center guy. I'm not employed in any way by this facility. I'm literally just another drunk on the street. And we come here because my experience is that when I get to show up for other people and try to pass on this message of hope to somebody else, it actually helps me stay sober for today. So I want to share a little bit of my, you know, what my life was like and kind of what has happened. First, I'll let you know, you know, my sobriety date is August 28th, 2011. So in, you know, next month, I'll be coming up on 4 years sober. And I have a sponsor. His name's Ron M. And Ron has a sponsor, and I have a handful of sponsees. And I'm a real alcoholic, and I want to talk about a little bit what's really important to me to kind of impart is what my misconceptions were about the idea of what an alcoholic was. Because, you know, like Brad said, I'm an alcoholic, and my alcoholism led me to a needle every day. And it led me to all sorts of other powders and plants. And I don't discriminate. You know, if there was something on the table that was going to change and alter my reality, I was there. And I always followed that. So I thought that if I just thought that I had to stop drinking and using, I had to cut those things out of my life and everything was going to be okay. And that I was going to be, that was the problem, right? I thought that if I could only just stop doing these things, then like my life would be okay. And what I've learned is that's not really true. It's kind of like the opposite. What I really found was a solution to a deeper problem when I started drinking and using drugs at a young age. I was in like seventh grade. I don't know what it's like, 12, 13 years old. And, you know, that was when I smoked pot for the first time. That was when I had my first drunk. And there's something that I hear almost everybody that I find that's in recovery talks about, this idea of being apart from rather than a part of. And what that looked like for me is I never really felt like I could fit in with people. There was always something that made me feel like I couldn't walk around and be comfortable with who I was. I walked around with the balls of my feet. I would lie and play along and try to make you think that I was cooler than I was, or I knew more than I did. You'd mention a band, and I would say, oh yeah, I love that band. I've never heard of the guy. You know, it's like I would do things to try to make myself fit in, and I was never comfortable just being me. That day that I, you know, with my first drunk, my first high, you know, those days in middle school where I moved around a little bit, so now I was the new kid, and I was kind of already outcast a little bit, and it's hard for me to make friends, and I find a group of people, and they're smoking a cigarette, you know, and the cigarette comes my way, and all of a sudden, I'm accepted into this circle of dudes, you know, oh, well, I'm like the kid who does this thing now. And then it was, oh, you know, you can smoke this thing and it's gonna mess you up. So then I'm gonna smoke that thing. And then it was like, hey, my parents have a bunch of booze in the basement. Let's drink this. And the one thing I noticed was that when those things started happening, I actually am an alcoholic because I have an abnormal reaction when those things go in my body. Because what happens when I drink or I use any mind altering substances is that all of a sudden I'm comfortable with who I am, and all those fears and all that chatter in my head and all that stuff stops. But I didn't realize that was what was going on. And it's been explained to me that, you know, what I found in those substances was really the first solution to my spiritual condition, which was, I have this thing that, you know, we call it the spiritual malady. And malady is just a word for illness or disease. And there's a book called Alcoholics Anonymous. I might refer to it as the big book. It's just the basic text that was written in 1939. Of this group that, you know, we're here today representing, or as a part of. We're just bringing an AA meeting, not like a representative, you know. So in the basic text, they use the words restless, irritable, and discontent. And I like that, and I think about it as like every morning I woke up and I felt like the world kind of owed me a little bit. And if, you know, I was always kind of angry at someone. If I'm waiting to check out and I've got 40 in my hand and it's 10:30 in the morning and there's a long line of people, I'm a little upset that I have to wait in line. You know, I just want to crack this thing open and get started. And I'm not really happy with my state of existence. You know, I look around at where my, if I have a job or don't have a job, where whatever's going on in my life, I wasn't happy. I was never okay with it, you know. And so I needed to numb out that restlessness, that irritability that I had with people, this like general sense of not being a part of the world. And I found that relief with the substances. And I found it in a bottle, I found it in a needle, I found it in a joint, I found it in women. You know, I found it with all these temporary pleasures. And I ran wild with it. And what happens to me is that my mind would start obsessing over it. You know, first thing in the morning, towards the end for me, and I'll give you guys some snapshots of what it looked like, but I want to cover this part of it first, is that, you know, in the morning, at the end, I would wake up, and the first thought was, I couldn't believe I was waking up at the end, because I wasn't going to sleep, I was just passing out. I was blacking out at some point and coming to at another point. And at the end, it was just, you know, I can't believe I woke up. Oh my God, I never want to do this. And oh my God, I never want to do this was followed by, oh my God, I have to do this, which was followed by, fuck it, I'm doing this. And that was my experience at the end, was I really kind of, and Brad said it too, you know, there was no enjoyment. I was just trying to maintain a way to get out of bed. And if I came to and there was any substance in my house, if there was a bottle, if there was any kind of powder, if there was any plant, if there was a cigarette, you know, I couldn't really take a step in this world without grabbing something first. And so a little bit of a snapshot. You know, I was 18, I ended up in a treatment facility. It was a 28-day program. My family found out I was shooting heroin in high school. My mom got a phone call on Mother's Day from a narco cop in the west side of Chicago that her son was in the city to buy heroin. I conversely was then grounded, and then I continued to get drugs through my friends. I would leave money in the mailbox because now my parents know everything, so I'm smoking cigarettes in front of them like I don't care. I would go leave 20 or 40 bucks in the mailbox. My friend would come by, pick it up, drive to the ghetto, come back to the suburbs where we lived. They would drop the dope in the mailbox, and I would get high alone in my house. And my parents were quick studies. They looked up what the effects of that drug would look like on me, and they started to ask to see my arm, and they started looking at my eyes, and they could tell when I was high. So they checked me into a 28-day facility, and I stayed sober and clean for about 3 months. And then I had already been accepted into like a college, and I was like, oh, I'm going to go to school at 18. And so I moved halfway across the country from outside of Chicago to Boston. And in Boston, you know, the day that my parents dropped me off and were like, I'm so happy for you and proud of you and excited for you, you know, that day, what was I doing? I was smoking pot with the kids in the dorms and drinking it. That was the only way I knew how to deal with life. That was the only way I knew how to socialize. You know, and we had visited Boston, we had gone to a couple of meetings, and I had a book with some numbers of people in Boston, so I was like, oh, I can call these people, and no, I just went right back to where I was, and that relapse was 6 years of my life, you know, and so I don't want to, you know, what's important for me to clue in is I hear people, they talk about, you know, they came into the rooms of AA or NA, they got some time together, and then they went back out, and a lot of times I hear that I went back out for 10 years, for 6 years. You know, and that's what my relapse was. It was 6 years of my life. It wasn't just I went out one day and smoked a joint or, you know, drank a beer and said, oh my God, I need to get back. This isn't working. It was 6 years later. And in that 6 years, I became a drug dealer. I got my teeth shattered by a dude, you know, broke into my house, home invasion style. I got brass knuckled in my face. My front teeth are fake. I got hit with a knife on my arm. I woke up in an ER with staples in my head, stitches in my lip. I had stitches in my arm. My parents bailed me out, you know. Oh my God, they're kicking me out of my house. Can you believe it? I was selling pot, you know. And my parents were there to bail me out, pay the money, you know, pay the hospital bill, whatever. You know, I've sold my body to get money to get drugs. I can't say I'm proud of it, but when I'm walking around the street and I don't have any other way and I meet the crackhead in the corner and we're smoking crack in an alleyway and he goes, hey, you can get in this car here and make 80 bucks. I did it. It only happened one time, and I can't say that again. I'm not proud of that fact, but this is where the spiritual condition that I see today as alcoholism takes me. And I even find in the book today, I was reading it, and they're describing the real alcoholic, and they even say that the real alcoholic will sometimes find himself on heavy sedatives like morphine. And it's in the book. I can't remember the page number, but it's like, you know, it's Alcoholics Anonymous, and there's a reason that I try to limit my sharing to alcoholism. But the way I see it, it's a spiritual illness that leads to a mental obsession. It leads me to all these other places, right? And so I had to realize that all those, you know, my solution of drugs and alcohol was actually not helping my problem. And my problem has only really helped when I started showing up to rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I believe that you can't lie to a liar. And I was a great liar. So when I showed up, I was looking for everyone's lies. You know, I wanted to see, I was looking at what people were bringing into the meeting. They got to be drinking, right? You know, I was like checking the Rolly cigarettes. There's got to be some, you know, they got to have something else in there. And I started hearing people's stories, and I started to believe that these people were like me and that I wasn't unique anymore. And I needed that. I needed to have this identification that I was just a run-of-the-mill, like, drug addict, alcoholic, and I was lost. And so what it looked like for me was I finally started coming back in, and my nickname became Two-Day Devin, because they do a day count. You know, they'll ask people to raise your hand in the first 90 days of sobriety and introduce yourself and say how many days you got. And I would show up. I couldn't make it on day one, because whenever I would go on a run, I would be too sick on day one. I would just be laid up in bed all day. I'd be hugging the toilet. You know, I'd just be stuck at home binge-watching TV or something. And I say home, this was still, you know, I have a loving family. I don't come from a broken home. I know a lot of people have broken homes, but I come from like a loving family that's pretty well balanced. I'm the only alcoholic in my immediate family. You know, my grandparents and stuff, the generation after my parents, alcoholic all over the place. But my parents, my sister, they're not alcoholics. And they were like, oh, you're moving to this new city, New York. We'll help you out for the first little bit so you can get planted and get on your feet, get a job, save up some money. So the only reason I ever had an apartment was because they were fitting the bill for the rent. And I was smart. I said, look, you got to pay me at the 5 days before the end of the month, because I knew I was going to spend it if they gave me that money at the beginning of the month. It was just not going to make it. So I couldn't make it in on day one, but I would show up and raise my hand and say, I'm Devin, I'm an alcoholic and an addict, I'm on day two. And then I would go back out, and it always, for me, at the end, it started with a beer. I would have a drink. And that one drink, it was like, all right, I got to go get messed up. This isn't enough. I could never just have one and say that was it. And so then I would go out, and it would be a couple of days or a week, and I would try to come back to AA. I couldn't make it on day one, so I come back on day two. So I got the nickname Two-Day Devin, because they kept seeing me for about two and a half months, showing up, raising my hand, saying I had 2 days. And I want to talk about that physical thing, that idea that I could never just have one drink, and then at the end, I had one drink, and it was all bets are off now. And that's like the last component of the alcoholism. If the first step is I have a spiritual condition where I have this restlessness, this irritability with the world, I don't really feel like I can connect with other people, and then my mind starts to spin out, and it spins out to the only solution I've ever known, which is the drinking and the drugs and all this other behavior. Once I actually start, I have that phenomenon of craving, which means I can't stop myself. And even when I was trying on self-will, like, I'm going to get sober and I got to do something different, there was a moment, which brings me to the August 28th story. There's this moment where, you know, they ask if you have a burning desire at the end of most meetings. The last 5 minutes, they'll say, if there's someone who really needs to share that's going to drink or use or hurt themselves or someone else, you know, now's your time to share. And I woke up that morning and I got myself to a meeting. And I had no plans other than I'm just, you know, same thing that I've been doing for 3 months. And that they asked for a burning desire, my hand shot up, and they called on me, and I had like almost an outer body experience where I heard myself saying something. And my share was essentially this, and I don't need to censor it because we're here, but it was, I'm fucked and I don't know what to do. And if I leave this place right now and I don't have another place like this to go to, I will be high or drunk by the end of the day. And that's just what is going to happen. And I like heard those words coming out of my mouth, and I didn't know why I was saying them, and I hadn't rehearsed anything like that. And then after the meeting, a couple of guys came up to me with a meeting book, and we sat down at like a place to get some coffee, and they started circling a couple of places. Like, here's a workshop, there's meetings all day here, you can just kind of go and hang out. And I met some guy at a 4:30 workshop, and he walked with me to a meeting at 6:45 up the street. And we hung out, and then after that, they went to a diner, and they said, some guy said, hey, come with us to the diner. So I showed up at the diner, and then all of a sudden, there's another 10 o'clock meeting somewhere else back where I started, the same room that I started that day, and I ended up at a 10 o'clock meeting. And I woke up that day around noon, and I got home around midnight, and I was sober. And in that meeting, when I had that, where I shared that I knew that I was in trouble, we say a serenity prayer at the end of the prayers right there on the wall. And when we all held hands, like, I got this feeling of the slight bit of chills down my spine and on my neck. And I identify that as a conscious contact with something that I don't understand. And I play music, and I've had a spiritual practice kind of related to this art form my whole life. And the only time I've ever felt the chills down my spine was in relation to that thing. And that was like when I was like 5 years old, I felt this thing with music, and I followed it. And then to be in a room of other people in recovery and to feel that feeling, it just kind of affirmed that I was where I needed to be. And I want to share the big things, which is important. You know, I come here to hopefully share what my experience has been, but the message is hope. And what happened to me on that day was the obsession that I was having in my mind to go pick up a drink and a drug was taken away from me. And I don't know why that was in that moment taken away. And a lot of people, it's an overtime process. There's an appendix in the back of this book. I was talking about Alcoholics Anonymous, and most of the people that are in recovery have an overtime experience that they call a spiritual experience, where the obsession is removed, but it might be over maybe a couple of months, a couple of years. One of our founders, it was a couple of years for him that he fought the obsession to drink on a daily basis for like 2.5, 3 years. For me, it kind of just left in that day. And I didn't necessarily think about it. I started going to 4 meetings a day. I had nothing going on. I just showed up because I had nothing else to do. And I realized that I was the problem and I couldn't do it alone. And when I became open-minded and willing to listen to these people that I had now deemed that they weren't lying to me, that I could look in their eyes and I could believe their story, it changed the game. It allowed me to kind of be open and to try something new. And so I want to bring it back. So when I say I'm an alcoholic, that's what I'm talking about, is that I'm an alcoholic, which means I have alcoholism, which is a spiritual condition that if I don't treat, leads me to an obsession in my mind that will lead me to a drink or a drug. And once I pick up the drink or the drug, all bets are off until I happen to get stopped again. And this last time I got stopped, it feels a little different. And, you know, we have a method to stay sober, and it's the 12 steps. And I don't want to get into all that now because it's a lot. But that's why if you hear someone say you should get a sponsor is someone like Brad or I that I've done the 12 steps. My sponsor has helped me get into this work, and he's taken me into this textbook and shown me what this is all about. And what it's given me is a simple outline for a light, a living in a one day at a time kind of way. And that's really what we get. You know, I don't get above human being. I don't get cured. The highest that I can get in recovery is just sober and clean. And how do I do that? How do I maintain my sobriety is really what I needed to know. Because I could, you know, if I went home for the holidays, I could maybe not be high or drunk for a day or two. But I couldn't just stay stopped. I didn't know how to do that. And that's what the people in these rooms showed me was possible. And so why I come here today, and the biggest thing that I want to let you guys know, is that no matter what's going on in your life today, you don't ever have to pick up a drink or a drug ever again. It doesn't have to be an option. And Brad is proof of that. You know, he's got 11 years sober this last weekend. You know, and I've got, you know, 3 years and 10 months or 11 months or so. And, you know, and what I do is I do this one day at a time. I wake up, you know, I hit a meeting in the morning. I talk to other alcoholics and I stay in touch with people. And then I use this network of people that actually do love me and care about me. And they might not like me. Like, I don't have to like all of you, but I love all of you in this room. And if you reached out and asked for help, I will try to be there to the best of my abilities that's afforded to me, you know. And that's what the program offers, or the fellowship offers. So, you know, I showed up to the meetings, and through hanging out and being a part of the fellowship and talking to other people in recovery and finding a sponsor, I got into the program, which was the 12 steps. And it's changed my life. And I get to walk around today, I'm free in a way that I can't explain. There's no one that I could run into from my past that I would ever feel like I needed to turn the other way and walk across the street. You know, my family, I've gotten a chance to go. I have a niece, you know, and I was home for Christmas. And they know that, they know I, you know, I was a junkie. They know I'm an alcoholic. They know I'm sober today. And I had a less than a 3-month-old niece sitting there, and they left her in my care. And that's that to me doesn't make sense. Because I've hurt these people immensely, and they're willing to trust this newborn infant to my care for like an hour when they went out to run some errands. Like, oh, can you just hang out and watch her while we go? And that to me is like a cash and prizes moment. You know, I didn't come in here to get the new car. I didn't come in here to get the house. I didn't come in here to save a relationship. I came in here to save my life. And that's happened. And now the rewards are, you know, I get to maybe help someone else today. And maybe not. You know, maybe I walk out of here and you guys all go back out and live your life the way you've been. And you know, the idea of service for us is like, this is how I stay sober. And so that's the message for me today is, A, you don't ever have to have a drink or a drug in your body ever again. And if you follow this program, it's very simple. We just don't have to, we just got to stop thinking. We got to get into our hearts and like get into this new solution and stay open-minded. And if we do this work, like the recovery rate is immense if we do the work. A lot of people just show up to meetings and they don't really do the steps and they go back out and they say this doesn't work, but they never really worked it. So they give it a bad name. And my experience is when I got into doing the steps and I got into this idea of a daily practice and trying to stay open to a conception of something outside of myself that is this loving spirit that wants me to be able to be of service today to others, my life is drastically different. And so I can't really think of a better place to be than with you guys right here tonight. And I'm grateful that I get an opportunity to come here. I don't have to come here. You know, I get to do this. And I think that I think that's all for me. So thanks for having me, guys.
Thanks for the powerful message, Devin.